Not Bitcoin Dip Podcast.
Hello there from Austin, Texas. How are you all? Did you have a great week? I've had an amazing week. It's been amazing traveling through South America. What an experience. So many cool shows recorded. Anyway, welcome to the What Bitcoin Did podcast, which is brought to you by Kraken, the best place to buy and sell Bitcoin. I'm your host, Peter McCormack, and today I've got an interview with Diego Gutierrez Zaldivar and Ariel Mislera discussing what Argentina can teach us about Bitcoin. But before that, I have a message from my show sponsors, and definitely don't skip this. Make sure you check them out. These are the sponsors that allow me to travel around and do all these amazing shows. So first off, we have BlockFi. Yes, the amazing BlockFi. My oldest sponsor, they've been with me for over a year, supporting everything I do. And when I was out in Uruguay, I got a chance to catch up with Zach Prince and Flory, find out what's coming up, finding out the new things they're releasing next year. There are so many cool things coming. I really can't wait to tell you about them. But anyway, they are the best in the sector. They are building a powerhouse of Bitcoin financial services. So if you need a crypto loan, you want to get something cool for the new year, you want to get yourself a deposit down for a Cybertruck, you want a flamethrower on the back of it, you want to take a trip to the moon, or if you've just got to pay the man, then BlockFi got you covered. And also, if you want to earn interest on your Bitcoin, Ether, or GUSD, well, they have dropped all minimum deposits. They have removed the early withdrawal penalty, and you can choose to receive the interest payments in the currency of your choice. I am a customer, and I love getting my interest at the end of each month. Been with them for about 6 months now, loving it. If you're interested in checking BlockFi out, I do recommend you do your own research. Then head over to BlockFi.com, which is BlockFi.com. And next up, we have the mighty Kraken, without doubt the best place to buy, sell, and trade Bitcoin. And they have also crushed it this year. We already know they have the best security in the business. No filthy hacker is going to get their hands on your Bitcoin because they have got it covered. If you didn't listen to my show with Nick Pococo, their chief security officer, you missed out. Go back and check that show out. But on top of that, they've got everything you could possibly need as a trader. They've got Kraken.com, the best place to buy, sell, and trade digital currencies. They offer you margin trading with up to 5x leverage. They've got futures. They've got indices. They've got the Kraken OTC desk, and I did a show with Nelson from that. You should also go and check that out. They've got CryptoWatch, where you can trade on multiple exchanges from a single platform, and they've just released Kraken Pro, a beautiful mobile-first app, so you can trade on Kraken wherever you want. If you want to find out more, head over to Kraken.com or download the app, which is available for the iPhone and Android. Just search for Kraken Pro, which is K-R-A-K-E-N-P-R-O. Okay, so onto the show. And while I was out in Uruguay at LibitConf, I had a chance to hang out with a whole bunch of people from Argentina. And having heard so much about inflation in the country and the negative impact that had on savings and wealth creation, I wanted to find out more about the Argentinian economy and why they're such a natural fit for Bitcoiners there. So I sat down with Ariel and Diego, and I discussed how Bitcoin is helping people in Argentina protect themselves against capital controls and hyperinflation. I think this is one of the most important shows that I've made, as it highlights why Bitcoin is so important to some people. Because the majority of people who are investing in Bitcoin are from first world countries and doing so really for financial gain, more speculation. So to hear how people can actually use it to protect their wealth from seizure or hyperinflation, it was very, very cool. Argentina's recent financial history is really interesting. I'd never heard of the Corralito before I did this show and, you know, read about it in the prep. And so we discussed that in it, but we also discussed the peso being pegged to the USD, hyperinflation, how it lost its peg, and the financial impact of capital controls. This show is really driving me to want to spend more time in other countries and find how Bitcoin can help people. I did do a bit of that out in El Salvador, and next year I'm going to be looking just different places around the world where I can go and learn about how Bitcoin is helping people, or even, you know, introduce Bitcoin to people who don't know how it can help them. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed this one. As ever, if you've got any feedback, you can hit me up. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. As I mentioned, I'm in Austin, Texas right now. I'm going to have a few days chilling out. After that manic trip to South America, where I was in Argentina, Uruguay, Bolivia, and El Salvador, recording a bunch of shows for What Bitcoin Did and my other show, Defiance, I am really exhausted. So I'm going to chill out for a couple of days. If you haven't checked out my other show, Defiance, really go and check that out. There's some great stuff on there. There's Bitcoin stuff on there too. There's a really good show I did with Andreas about why we need Bitcoin. So go and check that out. And any questions, as ever, please feel free to hit me up. Hello, Diego. Hello, Ariel.
Hello, Peter.
Hello.
We're here for a time of forgiveness for 1986, despite the fact your name is Diego and you're an Argentinian.
And I look like Maradona.
We can still be friends.
not only that, they call me Dieguito.
What does that mean?
Little Diego. And that's how they also call that Diego that we don't want to name.
For the whole of England, I offer forgiveness. We've moved on from there. No, but guys, like, great to meet you. It's great to come out to Le Biconf. Wow, what an amazing event. One of the most, I would say, one of the events I've been to that had the most cohesive kind of feel for people. Like, everyone felt like one. I've never experienced it as much as that. And now here we are in Uruguay in the most beautiful view and a great place to do an interview. But look, I really want to learn a lot more about Argentina. With Bitcoin, Argentina comes up as a lot, as a very good use case for Bitcoin because of the history of the government monetary policy. I've been reading recently about the Corralito. Have I said that right?
Yes, you said it perfectly.
And we're in a similar situation now. But before we start, we'll start with you, Diego, and then you, Ariel. For people who don't know you, just tell them who you are, what you do, and why we're here.
Well, I'm Diego Gutierrez Saldívar, also known as Dieguito. And, you know, I was one of the pioneers of the web back in the 90s. In 1995, I created a website for the main newspaper in Argentina, Clarín, that was launched in March 1996. So I saw the whole boom and bust of the web and the final realization of what was our view on how the web was going to change the world. And then in 2011, I got in touch with Bitcoin. I didn't get it. And in 2012, a good friend of mine brought me back into Bitcoin, and I had one experience that was very impactful for me. That was he sent, amid capital controls in Argentina, he sent the equivalent of, 5,000 Bitcoins. Back then was like 50K USD from the Silicon Valley to Argentina, and I sent them back. And the whole thing happened in an hour. We didn't have to ask permission from anybody. And then I said, okay, this is how an open financial system would look. And since then, I'm doing this, spreading the word, creating technology, creating organizations that spread the word in Latin America and make this open financial system a reality.
Great. And Ariel, I've just met you, but please do tell people your background, what you do.
Yeah, so actually we have a point in common in this story. So my background was, I've been working on the venture capital entrepreneurship space for the last probably 10, 12 years. And in 2012... the same friend that Diego just mentioned had a conversation with me, and he, you know, kind of like implied that Bitcoin might be worth $1 million. And he's a very, you know, smart guy, very well respected. And I said, well, maybe he's right. So I did an internal process, and I said, how much money do I want to leave my daughters so that they are not two brats? And I bought my first 6 Bitcoin in 2012, which I still have. They're theirs. And then I forgot about it. And a few years later, I remembered, because I looked at the pricing, and I said, oh, this is for real. And I called Dieguito, which we know each other for over 10 years, and he got me into it, basically. And I've been working around Bitcoin and with RSK since 2017.
Okay, so one of the interesting things for me to have this, one of the interesting reasons to have this conversation is I'm from the UK, so I'm clearly aware I'm from a relatively privileged position financially. You know, whilst the UK has had recessions, I've never experienced any kind of situation where I've had any kind of capital controls, any controls from the government, how I can use, spend my money, or access foreign money from foreign markets. I mean, not that I've ever had a massive need, but I'm just living in I've never lived in a position where I've had controls over me. Often Argentina is brought up as a use case. I mean, yeah, Venezuela's taken the limelight recently because of mass inflation, but often Argentina has been brought up as a use case. You know, you have suffered from inflation recently, but also somebody mentioned to me the Corralito, which is something I've read about. So it would be really good, either of you to go first, is a starting point. Just give me an understanding of the financial system in Argentina and the reasons why people kind of have a distrust of it.
I think, you know, Ariel is an economist, so he will explain it very well, but I think we have it all in Argentina. It's not only the Corralito, it's hyperinflation, it's everything you can think of in terms of economic, macroeconomic crisis, we have them. So maybe Ariel can go ahead and share some of those things that we live.
The description of a Corralito is actually hard to grasp for most people. It's basically the government deciding from one day to the next that you're not able to access your funds in your banks or in any other, you know, official financial system. And that happened the first time in Argentina in 2001. We had a huge crisis then. So it was a combination of, at that point, we had a pegged currency. So one peso, it was equivalent to $1. And, you know, for everyone, for the last 10 years, you could transfer money from one account in pesos to one in dollars. It was exactly the same. And suddenly, one day, they decided that you could not extract your dollars from the system. You go to the ATM and they start to say, okay, today you can only extract $100 per day. And then a few weeks later, they say, well, now you cannot extract anything. And the only way you could spend your dollars was by transferring those dollars within the financial system to other person. So it was basically, the dollars didn't exist. We were just, you know, fictitiously transferring money or paper money from one account to another. And that, of course, came in combination with saying, well, now that we have all this money or value locked into the system, now instead of $1, $1, we're going to decide that it's one peso equivalent to 25 cents of a dollar. So from one day to the other, you lost 75% of the value.
Historically, this peg of one peso to the dollar and you have it in your bank accounts, were the banks therefore buying dollars on the open market to represent this?
The government's promise was that they were not issuing any fiat currency, local fiat currency, unless they had a backing of $1 in their central bank. So in theory, there were exactly the same amount of physical pesos in the system that it was dollars in the central bank account.
Right, so they were claiming to be full reserve.
Yeah.
But do we know why they changed things? Were they stealing the money because the government was running out of money, or were they not operating the system?
Well, what happened is this system worked very well because before this we had hyperinflation and people were running out of the local currency, so there something needed to be done, and they came up with this idea of paying the dollars to the local currency, and for 10 years it kind of worked. Some of the things that helped this is during those 10 years, because we suddenly became a dollarized economy, all the assets, local assets, became valuable, and the government sold out or privatized a lot of the utility companies, etc. So they got a lot of dollars into the system as well from foreign investors. Eventually, the economy started to cool down, and basically the accounts of the government didn't close anymore. And there's no specific point in time, but they started to say, hey, what if we issue a little bit more money and we don't tell anyone, and then a little bit more, and then a little bit more. And of course, there's no way to know exactly, how many dollars are in the system. Yes. But then at one point, it became clear that the dollars were flowing out of the system, and then you have a run against the banks.
Yes, and also they were issuing bonds, and there were like a combination of things, and also the commercial banks. So it's related to 2008 crisis in a way on a local scale, because also the local banks were investing heavily in these high risk bonds, and when it exploded they were not able to cover either for all the investments they did. So it was like a total collapse of the whole financial system, and that created a lot of distrust in the banking system as well for a while, because then after a few years people started going back to the banking
system. Yeah, but the basic premise of having your currency pegged to another foreign currency is that you lose monetary policy. You only have fiscal policy. Mm-hmm. So you can increase or decrease the taxes, but you cannot issue, in theory, mm-hmm. more money to cover for deficits or for a short-term crisis in your economy where you need to inject money like the Federal Reserve does all the time, because they're able to print dollars if they need to. When you peg your currency, you lose that ability.
Yeah. So the Corralito essentially was a way of giving them control over monetary policy.
It was like, an alcoholic getting into recovery, basically. It's like you don't touch the issue machine of money. We cannot touch that because we came from hyperinflation. We cannot deal with printing money as a society. So let's get rid of that possibility. And that kind of worked. There were other problems that this generated, but kind of worked for at least, 5 to 6 years. Mm-hmm. And then it started collapsing.
Yes.
And what was the impact of the Corralito on people? Like, talk me through what the rules were, but what was the impact on people and business?
Well, not only on business, because you have to think that retirees had all their savings in this system. So it was devastating for the population. And, that triggered good things in terms of, for example, the one of the biggest barter networks up here. And then it broke because the means to register the bartering and everything were not good enough. And then, you know, the lack of transparency, you know, make the system fail. But you have maybe, I don't recall exactly the number, but 500,000 people in this barter network. Like, so I think it created like this awareness that people should take in a way economy in their hands. And but also was devastating because people that were like in their retirement years, suddenly they didn't have access to their money. They were very bad situations. You could feel it in the streets. You could see the sadness in the faces of the people. It was like very, very strong. And I don't know, our country always recovers somehow. but it was very, very strong. And I think that created an awareness of how macroeconomics can impact on people's daily life.
I think that the a secondary effect on all these crises that keep repeating in Argentina is that most people know that there is another crisis, big crisis coming soon. And so when things are kind of good for yourself, you try to, if you can, because not many people can, if you can, you save money in something that is not local currency or assets. You know, a lot of people buy, if they can afford it, an extra house. And by the way, there's no credit, so you have to actually have the money to buy the house.
I heard a story the other day. Somebody told me, Stacey Herbert, Max Kaiser's wife, I think she told me that they were in Buenos Aires and they met somebody. They told a story. Somebody bought a house and they turned up with two suitcases of cash.
That is how you buy a house.
Yeah. And the person they bought the house of had a coat created where all the money was in all the pockets of the coat, zipped the coat up. And the reason they did that is to kind of like hide it and protect the money.
Yes, that's correct. And usually you were like asking a couple family members to go with you because you were walking through downtown with the bills on your body.
Yeah.
I like to say that Argentina is the only country where you buy your groceries in installments and you buy your house cash.
So what do people do with the cash? They don't want to put it in the bank because they don't trust the banks.
Under the mattress.
That's
the traditional way of.
Okay,
I mean, now maybe you have other ways, but the traditional way of saving was like getting US dollars and putting them under the mattress.
Okay, but the secondary problem is there's not only the fact that you couldn't access the money, but the money was losing value.
Yeah, well, that's after this one-to-one pay we had with the dollar, then inflation started again. And indeed, we had like 25%. People say, oh, you are like, you have hyperinflation because now we have 50%. But the truth is, in the previous 15 years, you had 25% or 30% per year. But it was kind of predictable in a way. So people was adjusting to it. It's like the renting contracts were being done with that into account. So I think it's like the unexpected inflation is a problem, not necessarily, you know, the inflation itself, because people just adapt to it and do the deals in that sense. But and the inflation was caused by because they started printing money again, so that was, you know, transfer of.
The interesting thing and what I think that you start to see some aspects that make Argentina a hotbed for Bitcoin or other cryptocurrencies is. Even the people, you know, the lower income people that in Argentina is free to have a bank account. Everyone can actually open a bank account and the banks are forced to give you a free account. So the people that have a free account and, you know, they're like lower income, they trust the banks so little that they go at the beginning of the month and they take all their cash out in an economy with 50% inflation rate. So at the end of the month, you lost at least 5% of your purchasing power by keeping it under the mattress, because these guys are not the guys that are going to buy dollars. They keep it in pesos. But they are, you know, risk averse. They don't want to deal with banking and financial institutions.
And I guess they're living paycheck to paycheck.
Absolutely.
You know.
Yes.
So they'd rather have it in the pocket.
In the best case, no, when they have a paycheck. Then you have people that is living like with a financial horizon, maybe 20% or more now because poverty scale up. So maybe 30% of the population is living like with 1 week of financial horizon. So they live day by day with cash and that's how it works.
What about the wealthier class? You know, you can't keep $10 million, essentially like $10 million under a mattress. Are people trying to access accounts offshore? Are they trying to buy gold? Are they trying to buy other assets?
Well, I think real estate is
real estate mainly, and offshore mainly.
Yes.
Right. No, offshore bank accounts. That's the typical.
The big way. So if you are wealthy enough, you have ways to get out, unless you have capital controls. That's also what happened, because they started printing money, so they have this inflation rate, but also they have debt in USD, mm-hmm. you know, external debt. So they started like in the previous, not the last government, that the previous one, they started like converting external debt into internal debt. And then they fixed the dollar to peso ratio in order to maintain the cost of paying out that debt at a certain level. But then anything that you can use as an arbitrage mechanism becomes a way of doing like instant money. So okay. That's why they started with the capital controls, and they say, okay, you need to keep a balance between what you import, what you export. Then people was using stock that was being traded outside, like the main companies, I don't know, the oil companies in Argentina that trade in Argentina, but also in Nasdaq or in
I think another symptom of, you know, how this country is, you know, many ways unique, is that you can take a taxi and talk to the taxi driver, and he will know exactly what the price of a Bitcoin and the dollar and any other hard currencies is at that particular moment. And the same with, you know, when you speak to anyone, they know how much is the dollar that particular day.
Yeah, people is hedging all the time. It's like the regular people is hedging. And there are very weird patterns. Like at points of hyperinflation, for example, merchants automatically start, you know, keeping the goods because they know they would preserve value more than the cash. So they start like taking off the goods off the shelves because it's better to keep, you know, to stock than to actually sell. So it changes like many of the dynamics of the economics, like traditional, you know,
it's a story of, you know, constant abuse of the government to their people.
Yeah, I was going to say, why is there this endemic problem? Because it's like I've got to know a few people from Argentina. It seems like smart people, hardworking country, like people work hard. Is it mismanagement of money, or is it corruption, or is it both? Like, what is the problem that keeps happening?
Both, for sure. I think corruption is very high, and mismanagement is also in the. Yeah, I think it's a mixture of things, and also the lack of like a long term politic, you know, economic politics. Because each, for example, if the political party changes, they usually destroy whatever the previous one was doing. So it's like you are in constant change. You cannot do like long-term planning in terms of how the economics will be developed. And that's also very bad for...
Yeah, like, and you know, you can also track this down to historical aspects. Sometime way in the past, in the early 1900s, we were a very rich country. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, that memory of being rich is still ingrained in today's, you know, most of today's middle class. And so we think we're a rich country, but we're not. And we, you know, we have this crazy agreement as a society. We are a country that we have 30%+ people that are poor. And yet we offer a lot of, you know, free universal services paid by the government. But in their minds, in the minds of most people, they don't connect those two things. They think that this is free, and you know, there's nothing free. Someone's paying for it.
Of course, yeah. Right? But there is a history of socialism through South America, right?
Yes. I think, yes, in Argentina is a little bit different than the rest of South America in certain things. Maybe Uruguay is more alike in the sense that usually in Latin America you have, I don't know, 20% included into the system and 80% left out. In Argentina, you have a huge middle class.
Okay.
So that creates a different dynamic. And also this, you know, maybe what we were discussing, this awareness of how macroeconomics impact your life, this constant hedging. Also, Argentina has been like the leader in adoption of new technologies in the region, like internet, the first cable TV So in many areas, like social networks, it was. So I think that's why I think Bitcoin is actually at the crossroads,
okay,
of finance and technology. And I think that's why Argentina picked this up earlier than other places.
Okay, so we'll come to Bitcoin. Just another thing I'd like to understand. What is the political structure? Is it two main parties? Is it a socialist and a conservative party?
Now it's consolidating, but historically you had like one very strong party that is the Peronist movement that is very diverse. It's not a single thing. It's like multiple like entities that come together for the elections. So they have all these internal negotiations and then they come together for the election and then they distribute the power afterwards.
Right, okay.
And then you have different opposing parties that, you know, come and go. So
right,
you don't have actually like a bipartisan model, no? So
that seems like a way to maintain and control power, and not that no other party can really get enough votes to challenge.
Yes. Yes, and now you have actually the country split in two,
okay,
because in the last elections the Peronism won by little. They didn't want so basically you have the people that is fully aligned behind the Peronist movement and the people who is against it.
And what were they voting for? What's the new leading party?
The Peronist is the one, the new government.
But the thing here is that they win the election and then we're all, you know, scratching our heads to understand who exactly won within the Peronist party.
Yes.
Right.
Because it's not a single thing. So they are redistributing power and at the end you don't know exactly who will win within the Peronist movement.
it sounds like it's still there for... It almost sounds like it's still a dictatorship. It's like you can't vote for change.
Well, you can vote for change, but then, you know, reality comes and you go back to zero. That, you know, what Diego was saying, that we have this, I don't know, this tragedy of trying to change for a few years, and then it's not that you accept some of the good things that come, they just go back to the original one. So we're kind of like circling in the same area for the last maybe 20, 30 years. And it's sad because, you know, even though in the early 1900s we were super rich, mm-hmm, 20, 30 years ago we weren't super rich, but we were a leading Latin American country. That's not true anymore. When you look at other Latin American countries, they advanced a lot in many ways, and we kind of like stayed the same.
Yeah, historically, like Brazil was the leading country, mm-hmm, then Mexico was half of the GDP of Brazil, and we were half. Argentina was half of the GDP of Mexico. And then Colombia was maybe 60% of Argentina. Now it's no longer the case. It's like, you know, the other ones are growing and Argentina is lagging behind more and more.
So what's the impact of kind of the voice of the people? Like, is there apathy towards politics, or is there a bit more kind of activism, a bit more kind of a demand for change?
I think it's a super politicized country.
Yeah.
Right.
Everyone has a very strong opinion and, you know, it's really, really active.
Yeah.
And you know, in this last election, I think we had a turnout of over 80%.
Wow, that's really high.
Yeah, it's mandatory to vote, but even if you don't vote, nothing happens.
Nothing happens.
Yeah. So not really mandatory.
No. No. No, and you know, you had people in the streets for both sides, you know, in a massive way. Like, it was like... Like they were present, the Peronists were present in the street, and also Cambiemos, that is the opposite party, was also in the streets with massive amounts of people. So people get engaged a lot with politics.
Yeah. And is the division like a hard division, and does it lead to like a social unrest, or is it?
Yes,
it does.
Yes, it has been polarizing more and more over the last, I would say, almost 20 years, right after the
Corralito
and everything has been polarizing more and more. It's very divisive.
It's actually interesting because the manifestation of this is the Peronist Party, you know, people that are in favor of or whatever flavor, mm-hmm, and people that are against of whatever flavor. It doesn't matter. It's just as long as it's Peronist, I'm against.
Okay.
But if you look at a little bit underneath, there are a lot of real, you know, real values that are being fought. I think that historically, the Peronist Party, in one, there's one thing that they all agreed, which is, you know, big government that controls resources and allocates in the way that they think. So that's what they are for. And so then you have like people that are against that, but they are not organized against a unique idea. It's not that, well, I'm against that and I am a libertarian or I am a, you know, whatever, capitalist, extremist, or, you know, middle ground, whatever. It's like everything that is not Peronist.
Yeah. So the Corralito was in 2001.
Yes.
When did you come out of that? When
it started to recover. I mean, it took like for 1 year, money was completely locked. Then they started like give some chances or ways to get out. Mm-hmm. And as Ariel said, that was like at a discount. So you already had lost like 75% of your money.
Thanks.
Yes. Yeah. No, yeah, that's...
The other interesting thing that happened during those years, which is crazy, is that the local governments, the different, you know, states, provinces, started issuing their own money.
Yeah. Okay, wow. What? Hold on. That's not a small thing.
No, it was crazy. Because because the government was broke, effectively, and they still had this limitation of they didn't want to issue a lot of fiat money, national fiat money. You know, the provinces, the governments of the province, they needed to pay salaries. And so they issued different currencies, local currencies. And
so they just created a currency.
They created currencies. And it was, and it's, you should try to get one of those papers. It's like, it looks like, you know, funny money. It's like monopoly money.
So you had regional money, and then you had this barter network. So it was interesting because the system kind of created buffers.
And you could only spend them within the specific state.
Within the state. But so the local government, how much power does a local government have? Did the national government not issue any directive that said you can't?
Well, we are not really. I mean, that was a crisis. So they had the national government didn't have much choice because they could not also offer an alternative. But in general, I would say Argentina is not really a federal nation, in the sense that a lot of things go to the nation state and then get redistributed to the provinces or states. So it's kind of, I think it's a very centralized way of managing the nation.
The thing
the
is
nation.
That there are several provinces and states where maybe 60% of the working population work for the state.
Right.
So imagine, you know, if the state doesn't have money to pay the salaries, that is impossible, right? So you call the national government, say, hey, I need this money. And the government says, I don't have this money. The governor needs to make a decision on how to solve that problem.
So were goods priced in the national currency and the local currency?
Yeah, because these local currencies were pegged one-on-one with the national currency. But of course...
But that drives inflation as well, because that's just still money printed.
Yeah, but people was discounting on that. So if you
it was a way of cheating this one-to-one peg.
Yeah.
So what happened was, you know, we don't print national money, so everything is backed by dollars, but this other money on the side that the provinces are paying are printing, that doesn't count. But it did. And that was part of what ended up in the
one of the most famous ones was the Patagon.
I'm just looking it up on my phone. Mm-hmm. The Patagon.
Patagon and the Patagon, the PATACON.
Okay.
Patagon now is like a way of talking of things that have no value. It's like, are you paying me with patacones? It's like, you know, you're paying me with monopoly money or something like that.
Is there a black market for dollars?
Yeah. Now that you have capital controls again.
Yeah. So let's explain it again.
Then the black market appears.
So actually, we should go back a step. So you came out of currency controls, came out of the Corralito. What?
We had a 12-13 year run, of relative normality with inflation, which put us in the top three countries of inflation.
Yes.
With several major macroeconomic problems, but kind of making it. And then in the last year or so, things started to get bad again, really bad. And then at the end of the previous government, after they had lost the election, they had to basically lock the system again because a lot of dollars were coming out of the system.
So this is it here, right?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. I'll share that on the show notes.
So, yeah. So
it does. It does look like it's been on a computer printer.
Yes. and when you feel it, it's even worse. I think the image doesn't represent how bad the Patagon is.
I can imagine I can get some of that on eBay, right?
Maybe. Yeah. Maybe you can get them.
So you had a 12, 13 year. I don't want to say good run because you still had massive inflation, but like at least you had control over your money. And so what's happened recently? So because are people calling it like Carolita 2 or are they just calling it currency control?
Well, not yet, but it's coming. It's coming fast. Okay. So the first thing that happened is when the previous government lost the elections in October. Mm-hmm. That's the other thing that we have in this country that's kind of crazy. The election day is at the end of October, and the new government doesn't take power until mid-December. And in a country like us, which is full of volatility, having that huge gap without being actually powerless, but you already won, but you don't have power, that creates a lot of additional uncertainty, unnecessary uncertainty.
Well, what happens in that gap?
Well, what happens is that you have a government that lost, so they know that they are going. You have a government that won, which is, in this case, a Peronist party, but you are not really sure exactly what they are planning to do. So people get crazy. What they do, they start buying dollars. And, the central bank at one point, there was a week that maybe 8% of the total dollars in the central bank went out of the window. So after a couple of weeks like that, the central bank ran by the government that already lost the election, which actually won the election 4 years ago, saying the first thing we're doing is eliminating this crazy capital controls type of thing. They had to backtrack and set up this currency control, which is crazy. It's like today, Argentinians cannot buy more than $200 per month. And this is already confirmed by the new government that this is going to stay for a while at least. And then I think yesterday or this morning, they announced a new legislation where if you want to use your credit card outside of Argentina to spend dollars, the equivalent of spending dollars, there is an extra tax of 30%.
Wow.
Yeah. And, and then they are doing de facto capital controls as well.
Okay.
They don't say it openly. But they are also like, I know companies like trying to do exports or imports depending on the, and they are doing capital controls as well.
So the result of this is that you have a dollar that is the official dollar, which is around 60 pesos. And then you have a black market, which we call the dollar blue, which is around, right now, I think on Friday it was around 72, 73. I think that on Monday it's going to probably go to 80.
Wow. But the kind of body language from both of you is like, it's not like, I'm expecting social unrest and campaigns on the street, demonstration on the streets. It's like, here we go again.
This happened already. So it's nothing new. People is just trying to understand how bad it will be.
Right.
But it's not that it's something new.
I think the other crazy thing is that a lot of people think that this is the right way to do, the right thing to do. They think that the U.S., the capitalists are coming after us to screw the country. So all these capital controls or the.
Well, but I think it's a strategy. It's like what they are saying is we close the doors, we start printing. In that way, we control the exchange rate. We inject because the printing money goes to, to subsidies, to jobs in the state, like what Ariel was saying. So it's money that goes to the bottom of the pyramid and that, activates the economy. So it's a strategy, but it's a strategy
for a while until the next crisis.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But it's a strategy that detach you in a way from the global economy, because then as you have so many distortions in the local economy, it's almost impossible for the outsiders to participate there. But again, the main problem is like whatever economic policies you define, the main problem is that we are going back and forth between completely opposite economic policies, and that it's impossible to plan or to have any kind of predictability on how to develop your business in this environment.
Yeah. The other thing that happens is that because we have this crisis over and over again, the cycles where you can actually cheat and make people think that this is good become shorter and shorter. So now if on Monday the dollar goes from, because, you know, by the way, the dollar that everyone sees is the black market dollar because the other one is unavailable. If it goes from 72 to 80, so let's say 10% increase in one day, that immediately will transfer to prices in the local currency. So all the economy will adjust in within days to the new pricing. So that is just like a cycle where that never ends. And so the government actually thinks has a lot of tools, but it doesn't, because
that's the other thing that is very interesting. As people don't trust the government and they are always hedging, actually you have a bimonetary system, mm-hmm. you know, in place, even if it's not formalized, because people is, you know, storing their wealth in dollars, the ones that can, you know, so the government is managing the peso economy, but there's a completely parallel economy that is fully denominated in USD. So monetary policies have like limited effect, like what Ariel was saying. It's like people is always looking at the USD and then, you know, adjusting accordingly.
Just sounds like you need smaller government. Less government.
Well, that's
privatization.
But then again, that's the discussion in our societies. Like you have half of the population in favor of less government, or, you know, and then you have half of the population in favor of more government.
Because they are employing them.
Yeah. No, not only that. Yeah, because but it's a mindset. So, you know, it's like you have that you have a split society in that sense.
Do you get libertarians in Argentina?
We have.
This last election, I think it was the first time that the libertarians had a significant role. It ended up playing out in favor of the Peronist Party because it divided a little bit the electorate of anyone that was not Peronist. But at least they had a voice, and it has a lot of repercussion in terms of, you know, starting to put in the agenda the problem that it is to have such a huge government. The other interesting data point to understand Argentina is, you know, we're a country that has 30% of people that pay taxes, because one third of the population is poor, so they are not in part of the formal economy. Another third basically avoids paying taxes somehow. Cash economies and all that stuff. And then one third pays taxes to fund the government.
Right. Okay.
So it's not viable. The solution that we've been trying over and over again, in my view, the wrong way, is let's increase taxes instead of saying, why don't we? It's not even about reducing government. It's about being more fair in terms of who pays and who doesn't.
Yeah, but also you have very recessive taxes, because you have 21% VAT. So on one side you have like this thing that, you know, a lot of people avoid taxes, a lot of people, you know, cannot pay taxes because they are outside the system, but also when somebody buying food is paying 21%.
So they charge VAT on food.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Well, now they tried to remove it on certain articles, but that was just recent, like a month ago or 2 months ago. So you have this thing where you are trying to have, I don't know, equal opportunities or an egalitarian system on one side, but then you're creating a model that is completely recessive and that hits the same somebody that is trying to survive and somebody that it's well above the
historically the government has had a lot of power to go and interfere in people's and companies' lives, in my view, too much. Like, I give you an example, which is, you know, it's something that happens almost every time in Argentina. We have a crisis, you know, it's a huge unemployment rate. And then again, on Friday, last minute, 10 in the evening, the president decides that for the next 6 months or 12 months, you cannot fire people. Or if you fire someone, you need to pay double the penalty of firing them, which, you know, you could argue whether that is good or bad. And, you know, no one wants people to get fired, but we all know that the minute you do these discretional decisions, the companies already knew that something like this was coming, so they stopped hiring people many months ago, and they actually accelerated firing them because they knew that probably when the change of government happened, they would, you know, it would have more cost for them.
Next up, I talk to Ariel and Diego more about why Bitcoin is important to Argentinians. But before that, I've got a message from my amazing sponsors. So firstly, my newest sponsor for December, Scott Offord, and his company Crypto Mining Tools. Scott is a Bitcoin mining consultant. So look, if you are interested in Bitcoin mining, if you are already a miner or it's something you want to get into, but you want to speak to somebody about it, you want to find out more, you got to talk to Scott. If you go and check out his website, cryptomining.tools, he's got a Bitcoin mining profitability calculator there that he's made that you can use. You can enter your estimated uptime and get some realistic profit projections. It also includes the impact of the Bitcoin block reward halving coming next year, which everyone's excited about. And if you're wondering which miner is the most efficient or has the best chance of breaking even, you should try out their interactive hardware comparison chart as well. As an ASIC mining equipment broker, Scott helps you make data-backed decisions. He can help you find hosting or raw power and land to get your miners up and hashing. I've known Scott for over a year now. I'm regularly talking to him about mining. So if you want to find out more, definitely get in touch with him. You can find him on Telegram or Twitter. It's Offord Scott, which is OffordScott, or visit cryptomining.tools, which is CryptoMining.tools. And next up, we also have the amazing Dropbit, my favorite Bitcoin wallet. They've absolutely crushed it ever since launch. When they first got in touch, they were like, we're a Venmo for Bitcoin. You know, you can send and receive Bitcoin in really easy ways. You can even text it to people. Since that, they've added the ability to tweet Bitcoin to people. They've added Lightning. They've added the ability to buy Bitcoin from in the wallet. They've added support for Batch32 addresses. And they've got so much cool shit coming next year. Honestly, they're going to kill it again. If you haven't downloaded Dropbit, what are you doing? They've even unlocked Lightning for everyone. Come on, go check it out. It's available for the iPhone and Android. Just head over to dropbit.app, which is dropbit.app. And lastly, but definitely not least this week, is Wire, coming to the end of their sponsorship. So a massive thanks to the team there for supporting the show for the last 3 months. If you haven't checked them out, come on, go and do it. Check them out before their sponsorship ends. Let's give them a nice boost before the year's out. So what are they doing? Well, Wire are helping companies across the space offer Bitcoin onboarding. So whether you're a solo developer or a large team, if you want to simplify user onboarding and offer your users a fast and easy way to purchase Bitcoin, then get on the phone to Wire. Since 2013, Wire focused on taking care of all the heavy lifting, all the pain in the ass stuff like compliance, payments and liquidity. They take that shit off your hands so you can focus on your core offering. If you've got the idea for the next killer app, do not let the regulators kill it. You want to find out more, reach out to Wire or create a developer account at sendwire.com, which is sendwire.com. How bad is poverty in Argentina and how is it distributed? Like, because Max and Stacey were in Buenos Aires recently and they said, you know, it seems quite a wealthy city. I don't know much of the geography of Argentina outside of Buenos Aires.
Well, you have, I mean, the poverty in the countryside is maybe stronger in the sense that they are lacking everything. So it's lacking of infrastructure, lacking of, well, everything. No, it's like in the case of, but you have a lot of poverty in Buenos Aires that is, I don't know, concentrating half of the population of the country. So, and you have it like, sometimes you have it like inserted within the cities. I mean, if you go to Buenos Aires and you walk in the touristic part, or it's true that it looks like a wealthy city. It has a lot of influence from Europe, so it's a very beautiful city. But right there in one of the best neighborhoods, Retiro, you have Villa 31, that is a slum, right?
Like a favela.
Right there inserted into. So, I mean, yeah, you need to go to certain places, but not too far away. It's like that favela is like 10 minutes from one of the, you know, more posh neighborhoods in Buenos Aires.
So some statistics, as I said, is a third of the population is below the poverty line, and 50% of the children.
Wow. Okay. So the VAT thing was interesting because in the UK, we have similar VAT. Ours is 20%. But I'd have to double check, but I'm pretty sure it's not charged on food, children's clothes, and books.
Well, it makes sense. Yeah. That would make sense.
Yeah. And there might be some other things. There probably are, but they're the three main things. But but I guess like pretty much everyone in the UK is paying tax. There will be a small cash economy, but not a third. Mm-hmm. And there will be people who are not working. But I guess if you're only collecting tax from a third, this is a way of kind of still collecting tax from others, right? Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, so we should talk a bit about Bitcoin because of this. It's funny, like I said, for the UK, there's no use case for Bitcoin for me, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's speculative asset, so that's interesting. And it's also a good way I can invoice people. But it's there's not an actual, like, intrinsic need. Like, I can see now. And even when, even if Bitcoin loses, you know, value over a period of time, generally speaking, on a long enough time frame, based on the inflation rate of Argentina, yes, like on four-year cycles, it makes sense to hedge, to hold some Bitcoin. And to...
Yeah, absolutely. I did the math once. I think if you bought $100 worth of Bitcoin in 2013, you know, you could actually get 2 months, and $100 was not a lot of money back in 2013. It was not like even a week of expenditure, but you know, you could, like, 6 years later have 2 months of worth of living with the same amount. So in terms of it, I think it was like going from 6,000 pesos to going to 600,000 pesos over a period of 6 years. So that's the appreciation that Bitcoin has against the local currency.
And do you have a Bitcoin strategy yourself outside of your interest in it as a technology for people and business? Do you personally have a Bitcoin strategy which you use to hedge?
Yeah, I mean, well, yeah, I do have a strategy for hedging Bitcoins. Over time, Bitcoin became like a major percentage of my wealth. And as I'm a true believer, I really don't, I wouldn't recommend people doing what I do, but what I do is I just keep in fiat, in USD, enough for living a few months, so I don't have to sell Bitcoin at a bad price. But it has to do more with my belief or where I'm. So I wouldn't say that it's the reasonable thing. What I recommend people usually is like, put something in Bitcoin that if you lose it, is not going to affect your personal economy, you know, 2-3% of your wealth, something that really is not going to impact. But if you keep it long term, and that helps also to have the discipline of not, you know, trading, because what I saw is that people trading usually lose.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, 90% of people lose. Yes. Something ridiculous.
Yes. So what I tell them is like, set aside something that is not impacting your financial economy if it's lost, but you know that over time, if Bitcoin becomes digital gold and the world reserve of value, it will be relevant. So you leave something to your kids and you know, as a protection, as a safety net.
And Eru, you said taxi drivers, they tend to know the price of the dollar, gold, but you put Bitcoin in that basket. So is there widespread knowledge of Bitcoin in Argentina? And the reason I ask, I very, very... because people always say, what do you do for a job? And I'm like, I'm a podcaster. And they're, what's it about? And I say, well, it's Bitcoin. I never get people say, oh, what's that? Yeah, people, everyone's kind of heard of it now. Is that the same in Argentina?
So I wouldn't say everyone, but yes, this is, I guess, over average.
Yeah.
One thing is interesting to understand, another example where Bitcoin becomes super, super useful as a use case for the daily, you know, daily use. If you are a service provider, anything, you're a designer, you sell your services from Argentina to the rest of the world, today, based on the latest economic decisions that this government made, you are forced, when someone in the US hires you as a freelancer through Elance or some other of these platforms, they pay you in US dollars in a bank account, or they transfer you your dollars to your own bank account, mm-hmm, you are forced to sell those dollars at the official price, which I remind you is 60 instead of 80, and then get pesos. And so if you want to save, you can only buy $200 per month. So if you are doing kind of a good job, and you probably have more than that to buy back, just if you were able to buy back, you're basically losing that gap. But even that is impossible. So a lot of these service providers that are providing service outside of Argentina are turning to Bitcoin and other, you know, cryptocurrencies to avoid being forced to liquidate the hard currency and get the pesos.
Yeah, and I guess businesses can use them to avoid capital controls as well.
to a certain degree, because businesses are regulated, so it's not that.
Technically, yeah. What I just described is not necessarily the something that the government will support.
Okay.
But hey, you know, this is part of, you know, Bitcoin's ability to kind of like control your destiny without trying to break too many rules.
You know, but you've got the dollar limit. Is there what's the regulatory environment like for Bitcoin in Argentina?
Well, it depends, because you have multiple, angles. So you have taxing. On the taxing side, they impose something that is ridiculous, that they impose the same, like, they assume any operation with Bitcoin is, like, speculative. Mm-hmm. So they apply 15% tax.
1.5.
Two
profits?
No. Yeah, I think it's, like, I think it's off the transaction. But the thing is, like, is not enforceable. So they are treating like if all the activity in Bitcoin, like, they didn't understand that you can use Bitcoin as a payment means. And then if the other side is invoicing you, then you're already paying tax that transaction. Yeah, yeah. So they didn't understand the difference. They just wanted to tax it somehow. But as it's impossible to enforce, so people is not actually doing it that way. But yeah, so there's no understanding on the tax authorities of Bitcoin. Then on the AML's CFT bodies, the ones that are fighting money laundering and mm-hmm. financing of terrorism, they do have a proper understanding. We have been talking with them from the Bitcoin Argentina NGO, and they just extended regular procedures to cryptocurrencies, but they didn't do anything special. And then the central bank said that Bitcoin is not money. So they don't have anything to say about it. It's like, do it at your own risk. And then the equivalent of the SEC in the US uh-huh. also said, like, we are not going to intervene unless we think we should. So it's basically, do whatever you want. And if we don't like what you do, then we will see what to do with it.
What's the infrastructure like in Argentina in terms of exchanges? Are any of the major exchanges like Coinbase here, or is it localized?
Well, that's the thing. There's no proper regulation for exchanges, so banks don't want to open accounts. So you don't have actual, like, what you would call like the equivalent of international exchanges. You have brokers, and then you have exchanges that work mostly B2B.
Okay.
So they do, they provide services and mostly it's like remittances or offshore payments for service providers abroad using Bitcoin as a backbone.
And that is the legal part. We need to talk about the black market as well, because as with the dollar, I think the black market is a big part of the driver of the Bitcoin economy in Argentina, for all the reasons that I mentioned. I'm not, I don't think it's the right thing to do, but it's what's happening, right? So as with the dollar, there are people that are in the black market buying and selling, and it's relatively easy to access that, probably much more than most other economies.
There is a big OTC market, but it's not huge in terms of volume related to other economies, but it's something that is commonplace. You can do OTC transactions in Bitcoin.
So you can get Bitcoin okay, right? It's not hard to get Bitcoin in Argentina.
I would say in Buenos Aires or Córdoba, Rosario, the main cities, it's okay to get it. Maybe in the countryside and smaller cities, it's not that easy.
Right. And is there a premium being paid compared to...
Well, yeah, if you go through a broker or you do OTC transactions, there's a premium that can, it depends on the state of the market. No, usually when you have all people wanting to come in, that's usually on the bubbles, then you have a big spread. It can be like 10% between the buying and the selling point. Regularly you have maybe -2, +2, -1, +1. So
the other thing is that the Bitcoin price is of course tied to the black market price of the dollar.
Yes, so of course, yeah.
That always happens. And the other thing is that with capital controls, where you cannot actually take some dollars out of the country, if a company wants to send dividends to their matrix, they can't right now. Now, of course, you know, publicly held company will not do anything like using Bitcoin to jump that legal barrier. But a lot of other, you know, smaller companies that have private investors, etc., they want to get some money out of the country, then they go to dollar or they go to Bitcoin.
Yeah, there's like a lot of one thing called cuevas, that is like an alternative financial system that do this kind of arbitrage, where you give them the money. The money in Argentina, and they somehow will manage to give you the money.
And that is an infrastructure that is there. You know, it's been there forever.
Forever, yes.
And it's part of it's a result of so many years of capital controls and, you know, crazy macroeconomic.
Yeah, it's like the whole society is already prepared to do that.
Yeah.
To adapt to these capital controls and everything. And Bitcoin is becoming more and more a part of that infrastructure.
Yeah,
but the infrastructure was already there.
Okay, it's really fascinating, actually. It's let me ask you another question as well. Okay, so something that's come up a few times, like I'm a Bitcoiner, right? I've looked at altcoins. I've kind of always come back to Bitcoin, but a few times some people who are in the Ethereum community have pushed stablecoins to me, and they tell me a specific story of one guy in Argentina who's been using stablecoins himself because, you know, but Bitcoin has a volatility risk. Obviously, the peso has a volatility risk, which is usually downwards. But it's maybe a bit more useful to be able to have access to stable coins as well. Is that also a highly relevant part of the market?
Well, I think not yet. I mean, of the market of crypto consumers, I would say Bitcoin is still the most relevant part. But of course, I think if you have a stable asset, if you have a dollar-denominated crypto asset, then can appeal to a broader audience, you know. But I don't think the people that are getting into the Bitcoin space would like to get into, because they have other ways to
get dollars.
But it's true that if you are lower middle class or even lower class, that then you don't have access to the dollars, because these things are something that the middle class can access.
Right. Okay.
So I think there is some opportunity there to socialize the access to USD.
I have a slightly different view here.
Okay.
I think that stable coins are actually one of the biggest opportunities in a country like Argentina. The reason is because today, if I sit down with a friend, you know, I have a lot of friends, they have no contact to the Bitcoin world. Every time and they're all economists. I am an economist, so all my friends are economists. They did quite well. Every time I sit down with them and try to sell them the Bitcoin proposition, they laugh at me. They don't get it. It will take a lot of time for them to understand how come this value is created out of nothing and no one controls it, and the price is, you know, I'm telling them you should put some money in Bitcoin because the price will go up. It's a very hard proposition for someone that is completely out of, you know, understanding how the technology works. If I tell these same people, hey, here's a place where you can save dollars or euro or whatever other hard currency outside of the risk that putting the money in an Argentinian bank brings, that is a much easier conversation.
No, for sure.
And especially when you start adding the, you know, limitations that is, you know, even if they want to go and buy dollars at the bank, as I said, you can only buy $200. But you can, in theory, you can go to an exchange and buy Bitcoin, but only to buy stable assets. So you don't even have the exposure to Bitcoin, and then it's yours. And I think that is
no. The value proposition is there. What I'm saying is, it's not happening yet.
Yeah, it would still have to be a black market, right? Because as soon as you buy more than $200, the government is going to prevent it.
Yeah, this will be peer-to-peer. Peer-to-peer for sure. But yes, no, I agree with Ariel that the potential is there. What I was saying is, it's not the case yet. But the potential is very big.
Today might be a black market because of the current situation. But I think once we break that and people understand that, you know, owning a cryptocurrency, even if it's a stable asset and not Bitcoin, has a lot of additional features instead of, you know, putting your money in a bank. And then, you know, again, part of what we described before about the macroeconomic cycles in Argentina, banks screwed up a lot of people many times. So, you know, people forget about those things, but every five, seven, 10 years, we are reminded that the banks are not there to protect their assets, right? So if you find a way of solving that problem, even if people, you know, people will be willing to actually pay and pay taxes, and you know, I think that if someone comes and sets up a, you know, crypto bank, formal, official, etc., they will be successful.
Wow, interesting. So what's your experience? Well, obviously you're on the ground, you're talking to people, you're trying to educate people. Is it hard?
Well, I think, you know, and I agree with Ariel that we need bridges, and that's part. I started, for example, putting a group of voluntaries in 2015, mm-hmm. with whom we went into the slums. We invited social entrepreneurs to sell their, you know, their products, dumplings and things on our meetups in Buenos Aires. And at the beginning, we were doing that with Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
But then, again, for them was like going from physical, like cash, into a digital economy. Mm-hmm. So that was already like a learning step, a big jump in terms of understanding. And then they had to incorporate like another currency or asset. So I think we need to create bridges that people, that so we change one thing at a time. And once they are into the digital economy, it's easier to, I think it's tough when you have to teach them everything, like,
yeah,
because you have to tell them about digital money, which is not commonplace yet.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's happening already because many fintechs are like offering services on the smartphone, so that's getting more widespread. But then also you have to start talking about like short-term money that devaluates to a certain degree, and then long-term money. So yes, it's an educational process, but people can relate to it. And as Ariel said, if you have money that is fully in your control, I think that's something that it doesn't matter if it's a stable asset or if it's Bitcoin, people will value that. Like,
yeah. Yeah.
The challenge here is to convey that message in a, you know, in a credible way. I think that the minute that the average Argentine understands that there is a parallel financial system that is not centralized,
yes,
they will jump. So I think that our job is by creating new tools, new financial apps, etc., to get them more comfortable getting into that.
Yeah, I think that's the other thing. The technology was not reaching. I mean, we were working a lot on protocols. We were working on the low level stuff that needs to happen to get to the end user. And just now we are actually getting into the application level, you know, creating user experiences that are tailored for the mainstream. So if you ask me, I think 2020 will be a year where we will hit the ground.
Because you're not just teaching people why Bitcoin is important and how it works and why it's, you know, this, like you said, a parallel financial system. But then you're also going to have to teach them about block times and transaction costs, and then managing your private keys. And you, there's a lot of other things to teach people.
Well, I think the challenge is how can we avoid them to like, can we figure out a model or a product that doesn't need the end users, the 30% that are, you know, poor, or even the other 70% that are not poor but they cannot save money in a currency that they want? Can we figure out a way so that the complexities are managed beyond the scenes?
And the problem is there's always a trade-off, though. That's the thing.
Yeah, but I think that, you know, that's why I think Argentina is kind of a unique place, or as Venezuela. You know, these are societies that have suffered so much. They have been exposed to so many crises. We can, you know, these are early adopters. If you throw something there to test, they are willing to lose a little bit of control because they know that when they send the money to the banks, they're losing all the control.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, and I think it's like, again, it's building bridges. Once they are there, then you can teach them about the, you know, the values or the ethos behind the... But the first thing is we have to provide value for them. Once we provide actual value, then they will listen. And it's like everything. If you have a skin in the game, then a part of your mind will be present there. So we need to, you know, break that barrier so people has a skin in the game in this new financial system. And then we can educate them.
Today, most people in Argentina, the ones that are able to save some money, you know, yeah, a portion of them are able to buy assets that are tied to dollars or hard currency. Most of them just save in pesos and hope for the best. But the reality is that last year they lost 50% of that value.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah, and look, you know, it sounds like the Corralito was awful and you clearly don't want another one. But I guess if it happens again, it simplifies your job of explaining Bitcoin to people.
Well, if, as I said, this huge barter network was very successful. So yeah. I think, you know, if that happened again, now we have the tools for people to take that to the next scale.
Yeah.
But really, if you ask me, I don't want to see that happen.
No, of course it's like, you don't.
There's so much suffering in that.
I also think that, you know, being through all this crisis makes the average Argentinian be, you know, mistrust a lot of these schemes.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, on one hand, should be easy, but on the other hand, you know, people are like, yeah, sure, exactly. Are you sure you're not going to run away with my money?
Yeah.
Someone, you know, who's this Satoshi guy? You know, so.
Does Argentina need any external support to help with Bitcoin, or do you have everything you need on the ground? Like, do you look externally for help?
Not really. I think Argentina has one of the, you know, more developed Bitcoin and crypto ecosystems in the world, I would say. Buenos Aires is considered like one of the, and you have like leaders in the space, like in many areas, in Bitcoin, in Ethereum, in EOS even, you have some of the core developers there. Yeah, but what I mean is
the technology
is being pushed there.
But also, so, we say Argentina, but there was clearly a LATAM community as well.
Yes, yes. I'm saying Argentina because Argentina has been leading, but we have strong communities also in Mexico, in Brazil, with different focus, like... Maybe Brazil is more about the trading, more about the financial aspects of it. But then in Colombia, you have very good teams working in Chile. Paraguay is starting to have some movement. Bolivia is completely forbidden, but you have some people trying to do something there. Then you have Central America, where you have Panama, Costa Rica. So really you have a Latin American community that is emerging, and I think Latin America will be clearly, because of the need.
Yeah, the need.
Exactly.
Right, yeah.
It will be one of the places, if not the place, where these tools will really hit the mainstream and be valuable for people.
Well, it's been really useful for me to learn more about it. It's a lot more interesting, actually, in the world of Bitcoin, beyond just kind of like number go up and speculation.
Yeah.
The fact is, if you could actually solve a problem for people, if you could see like a significant percent of Argentinians actually realize that this is actually a very useful tool, there's a definite use case, and if you were to see massive growth, that would be super interesting.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I like one thing that Andrea said, that usually when he goes around the world, he has to explain why.
Yeah.
Here, when he starts talking about Bitcoin, he has to explain how.
Yeah.
It's like,
I've heard him say about that.
Yeah.
All right, well, listen, look, if anyone wants to find out more about any of the work you're doing, I don't know how much that applies to you, Ariel, but like, please do tell people like your Twitter or your websites, anything you want them to follow.
My Twitter is @BlueLabel.
Okay.
And easy to follow.
Yeah, my Twitter is Dieguito, like little Diego.
You're probably going to have to spell that.
D-I-E-G-U-I-T-O. And also, you know, I'm the CEO of IOB Labs, the company behind RSK, Reef, and now Taringa, the biggest social network in Spanish.
Nice.
So you can go to ioblabs.org and you will find, you know, all the information of what we are doing in technology and in our vision of how this will come together on top of Bitcoin.
Amazing. Well, listen, thank you to you both coming on. Look, we did this at really short notice, but I think that was a useful one. So thank you both for coming on. If you ever need anything, you know me now, so just reach out and let me know, yeah?
Thank you, Peter, for
inviting us. Pleasure.
Okay, so what did you think of that one? Did you enjoy that as much as I did? As I said, I think that's one of the most important shows I've made. It was really good to learn about how Bitcoin can help people, like actually really help beyond just some speculative case to make a bunch of money and get a Lambo. I always get the chance to speak to a lot of people and get a lot of different perspectives in the interviews I do. But if you are from the UK or the US, you are probably in a more of a privileged position. Even if you don't like central banks, at least it works to some extent. At least you don't have the levels of inflation and hyperinflation that some of these countries have, like Argentina, and, you know, I've covered Venezuela before. So to hear about how Bitcoin is being used effectively to help preserve normal people's capital is really cool, and to help prevent against asset seizure. So I love doing this interview, and I want to say a big thanks to Ariel and Diego for coming on at short notice. And yeah, if you've got any feedback, you know you can hit me up. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. As ever, and as we come to the end of the year, just a massive thanks to everyone who supports the show. It's been such a huge year. So many amazing interviews. So much has happened. Honestly, I couldn't do it without your help. I've had a few of my own crazy moments, you know. It's been a bit stressful, and I've been tired and jet lagged traveling around the world and lost the plot a few times. But honestly, I love making the show, and I really do appreciate everyone who supports it. If you enjoy the show and you haven't ever done anything and you do want to support the show, there's a whole bunch of things you can do, and it's all listed up on my website, whether you leave me a review on iTunes or you just share the show out with your friends and family. Anything you do helps with the show. As I mentioned, I'm out in Austin, Texas. I'm having a few days to chill out after this manic trip in South America, but I did record a bunch of amazing shows out there, for both for What Bitcoin Did, but also for my other show, Defiance. And like I say, if you haven't checked out my other show, Defiance, please do. There's a bunch of cool interviews. Not really Bitcoin, it's more activism and politics and interesting subjects like that, but I did just do a really interesting show about Bitcoin with Andreas about why we need it. Anyway, as ever, you got any questions, hit me up. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com.